Okay, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for coming. We have validations. I'll be standing on the side there near the sushi, guarding it. And I have both validations, if you need parking validation. Unfortunately, the only kind of validation I can provide tonight is parking validation, but Rabbi Rosenzweig will provide deeper validation. And for those of you who would like CME credits, we have little flyers to explain where to text the number for the credit. I'll also bring those and put the stack near the flyer, near the sushi there on the side, so you can get your CME credit. We are so honored and excited to welcome you here tonight. This program would not have been possible without Susan Katz, our sponsor. Susan, who is a friend and a colleague, she's a fellow chaplain, someone who I've looked up to, respected for a number of years, came to me with this idea, 4 years ago? What it took us so long? It was just a small little glitch, which was COVID. Because we were ready to do it, we were starting to plan it, and then I thought, you know, maybe we should wait a couple weeks until this pandemic passes, and 4 years later, we're here. We did it. We finally did it. I mean, it almost didn't happen again because Rabbi Rosenzweig, who's our speaker tonight, flew out here from Israel this week where he lives. And right after, you know, he texted me earlier this week, you know, I don't know if I'm able to come. I hope you can understand. I'm going to try to work it out. Thank God he did come. But we really, really appreciate Susan's sponsorship in memory of her brother, Kenneth. And we'd like to call up Susan to share a few words.
So I was telling Rabbi Rosenzweig how I came all the way from Canada to be here, to hear him speak, but he came all the way from Israel, so I'm really, really so grateful and appreciative of how difficult things must be right now there, and that you're here with us nonetheless. I'm also pretty short. So I wanted to say a few words. I'm Susan Katz, and I wanted to say a few words about my brother, who was the inspiration for having this evening, and I'm so glad to see so many people here. So Kenny and I were typical children born in the Jewish suburbs of 1950s Los Angeles. He was naturally aggressive, and as my mother wrote in her baby's diary, he was also easily rebuffed by other children. My brother grew up believing that when he hurt others, they deserved it, and when they defended themselves, his victims were being the perpetrators. In other words, he was nurtured into becoming a perpetual victim. His crimes and misdemeanors escalated over time, whereas I moved on to university, marriage, and family life. In 1980, he appeared on the People's Court in order to have his legal costs covered in a lawsuit for having physically threatened a tenant whom he had subleased our parents' home to. And as he was led out of the courtroom, his final words to the camera were, "Hi, Mom and Dad," and a wave. Between 1999 and 2001, his convictions and trials were covered regularly by the Monterey County Herald newspaper. These included biting the other driver's arm during an act of highway road rage, and finally throwing gasoline on our elderly mother while she stood at the kitchen stove, and then attempting to beat our father to death after pinning him under an umbrella stand. They were rescued by the unwitting tow truck driver who brought the can of gasoline, having believed my brother's story that the car in the garage was out of gas. While he spent time incarcerated, my brother's records show that he had frequent conversations with the prison chaplains. He loved Judaism and wanted the verification from the chaplain that it would be safe and healthy for him to return to the synagogue in which he had been on the board of directors. He had had to leave under a restraining order due to the board's concerns about their personal safety. Yes, this sounds like a horrible fiction, but sadly it is not. You were right, Susie, my parents said when they came to Vancouver to stay with us after the gasoline incident. You said he would try to kill us one day. As usual, they dropped all the charges against him as he remained in their eyes a victim, but now a victim of the terrible state mental health and correction systems. He was adrift with serious addictions to alcohol since grade school and now psychiatric medications, as well as a myriad of self-inflicted, what he called klutz accidents that left him physically and visually crippled. In 2004, after a short stay in an acute psychiatric ward, he was discharged with enough antipsychotic medications to tranquilize an elephant, on top of the collection of medications he'd already been stockpiling. My brother died alone in a rented room in Salinas. He was a Dean's List scholar and graduate of UC Santa Barbara, a very successful early salesman for personal computers, and then real estate. He was buried in the Jewish section of the same cemetery as my writing muse, John Steinbeck. My parents moved to another state shortly after his death and never spoke of him after that. I continued to observe his yard site. Sadly, when I went back many years later to visit his grave, it was almost impossible to find. When I called the cemetery office to get the plot number, they had no record of it. But I had been at his funeral. So my parents had given the cemetery false birth and death dates. The office corrected the errors after I sent a PDF of his death certificate. Of all the terrible things that had happened to him, making him no longer exist in this way was the worst. That is what prompted me to make the donation for this program, to help illuminate and educate and honor those in our Jewish communities who live with addiction and mental health challenges, and those of us who care about them, that as Jews, we are all a creation and reflection of God's image. So thank you. I'm very much looking forward to the program. Thank you for being here.
Wow, thank you, Susan. His memory should be a blessing, and what an incredible thing that you are keeping his memory alive in this way, and such a fitting event. We really appreciate it, and it speaks to the reality of what we're here to deal with. And in fact, I didn't know if anyone would show up. I told Rabbi Rosenzweig, I hope some people make it. I apologize if it's very few, but I think this topic, it touches a core. There's something that we need to talk about here, and it's not talked about enough in our community in general, in the world, but in our community as well. And so it's so important that we're here together. Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig is a figure who I have looked up to for a number of years. He is a rabbi. He lives in Beit Shemesh in Israel. He was a rabbi in a yeshiva. He published actual responsum as a really rabbinic scholar. He's a teacher to many in many different institutions in Israel, also a community rabbi of a synagogue in Jerusalem in Beit Shemesh. And a number of years ago, he began being asked questions related to mental illness and Jewish law. And he decided, instead of just kind of giving whatever answer he could come up with or whatever answer was out there, first he realized most of these issues had not been dealt with thoroughly by Jewish law. And he decided to research them, to study them with mental health professionals, and slowly but surely developed an expertise in this field. And I personally have watched that happen, going from someone who was simply trying to help to someone who is literally an expert in the field. I bring my own most difficult questions to him. Rabbis around the world now turn to him. He recently wrote an incredible book. Right now it's in Hebrew called Nafshi B'Sheilati, though he tells me that the English edition is due out in just a number of months. So keep your eyes out for that. It's a masterpiece because it's thorough, it's detailed, it's scholarly, it's sensitive, and it's unprecedented. It just doesn't exist literature like that. And Nafshi B'Sheilati, it's coming out in English. Also, his website, we'll put it up, we'll make sure to write it up on the board, magleinefesh.org. Say again?
mnefesh.org.
mnefesh.org. I'll write up there, mnefesh.org, because I forgot to bring the flyers. My apologies. Though, again, we have validation. I'll be standing by the sushi. If you need parking validation, also for CME credits, come to me for the flyer. But without further ado, we're so honored to welcome all the way from Israel, who didn't cancel because of this event. He felt it was so important. Once again, thanking Susan Katz in memory of her brother. Please help me welcome Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Thank you, Susan, for facilitating this event. And thank you, everybody, for coming out. It's not a simple thing to come out on a weekday. I'd probably be home right now if I were you, but I appreciate, you know, everybody coming out. I do think it's an important topic, and I do have quite a bit to share with you. Rabbi Weiner, is it Wiener or Weiner? I never. It's Weiner because I hear some people say like this, some people say like that. So Rabbi Weiner was generous to take the fault on himself, which was the flyers. I forgot the flyers, but I will put the organization's website shortly on the board. It is important for me that you know who we are and what we do. But before I get to that, I will complete Rabbi Weiner's short introduction. So I'm 43 years old. I'm married to my wife, Alana. We have five children between 12 and 21. The one who's 12 is almost bat mitzvah. We'll have a bat mitzvah shortly after we get back, hopefully with the war and everything. We'll see how that works out. But yes, 5-6 years ago, I received a few questions that have to do with mental health and halacha. I will discuss what that means in a moment, and realized that I did not know the answers and that there was nowhere really to look up the answers either. I had a relationship with Dr. Shmuel Harris, a psychiatrist who I met when I was on Shlichut in Melbourne, Australia. I was there for 3 years between 2006-2009, and we were learning together anyway. So I went and I said, let's learn. You'll bring your psychiatric knowledge. I'll bring my halachic knowledge. And let's learn together and we'll understand what to do in these cases that I am asked about. And very quickly, I realized that instead of answering a few questions, I could write a book about all these different issues. And we sat and we learned for 2 years before I wrote anything. And after 2 years, I put together a first draft, and then I went and I got it peer-reviewed by rabbis and mental health professionals. And after 4 years from the beginning of that project, I found myself with a book that was published. But the book led me to another initiative, which is my non-for-profit, Magle Nefesh, mnefesh.org, which basically deals with three things. It trains rabbis. I will relate to that momentarily. Train rabbis. There is a helpline. I don't call it a hotline because it's not 24/7. It's a helpline. People reach out and they set up a time to speak. We know we give them a significant amount of time, 30 minutes, half an hour, and they can choose the mode in which they want to ask their question, whether by chat or by Zoom or by phone. Every person is comfortable in a different way. And so we want to give them ample time and to let them choose the mode in which they want to converse. And the last thing that I do is what I'm doing here right now, raising awareness about mental health. What is mental health and halacha? What questions do you get asked, Rav Yoni? So I will give you some examples, okay? For example, someone with borderline personality disorder, okay, who has trouble regulating themselves throughout the week and use their phone to do so. Can they use their phone on Shabbat? Usually on Shabbat you can't use a phone, right? So what happens if they say, without a phone, you know, I have a meltdown. I can't cope. It is my coping mechanism throughout the week and I also need it on Shabbat. And it's not just with borderline personality disorder. I had a woman about 4 years ago, 5 years ago already, I don't remember exactly. You know, she reached out to me By the way, I say it right from the start, and people usually give trigger warnings. My entire being is one big trigger warning. Okay, you should assume that I will say things that are a little bit hard to hear. Okay, there's one huge flashing trigger warning over this entire talk. There was a woman who reached out to me. She had an eating disorder. She had depression. She had anxiety. And she asked me what to do on Shabbat. I said, what do you mean? What would you do during the week in order to cope? She said, during the week, I take a hot shower and I listen to music. So I said, I understand. I understand why you think you can't do that on Shabbat as well. But before I answer you, what have you been doing? This didn't, she was calling me like on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. This didn't start Sunday, right? She's been going through this for weeks or months or years or who knows. What have you been doing until now? So she said, well, until now, what I've been doing is either I have been causing myself to throw up or I have been cutting, right? That's what she was doing. So in other words, we have to understand there's no vacuum. It's not like someone's waiting for me to paskin, and if I don't paskin, then they just won't do anything harmful. They're doing whatever they're doing anyway. They're coping in some way. The only question is whether they're coping in the right way, both from a halachic perspective and from a health perspective. Are they doing the right thing? Right? So we need to deal with that, right? So phone on Shabbos, very big question. Maybe the most prevalent question I get, because for many people with mental health disorders, the phone is a major coping mechanism. Question number two, a hug during Nida. Nida is, as many of you know, the time of the month where the woman is menstruating, and during that time, she's not allowed to touch her husband, right? There are, I guess, on average, we say about 12 days of the month that a woman is not allowed to touch her husband, right? Many men or women who are suffering from depression need a hug. They need a hug in order to get through a depressive episode. What happens in that situation? Can they receive that hug from their husband, from their wife, in that situation where they are in the halachic status of Nida, right? So another example of a question that I'm asked quite often. And by the way, in this last war, I was asked it a lot. This war, the moment it started, right? We have 350,000 people who were drafted. People, put on their army clothes, they packed a quick bag, and they're about to leave the house. And no one expected this. They don't know if and when they're coming back. And people were asking, can I give my husband a hug goodbye? Right? What if I'm in Nida? Can I do that? Maybe, I don't know when next time I'll see him. Right? People are still asking me that question now. Right? At the moment, Israel's kind of holding its breath. At the moment, we're before, people go in. People are coming back for 24 hours just to say goodbye, and then they're going back to the front lines. I'm being asked this question almost every day. All the time. It's a mental health question too, right? Because people want to know that they said goodbye properly. Are they able to do so in that situation? People know about depression. People know about borderline personality disorder. But do you know about other sorts of disorders which also have questions that are related to that? I have questions about something called trichotillomania, hair pulling disorder. Hair pulling disorder is exactly what it sounds like. Okay, people pull their hair. Okay. You might say, okay, that doesn't sound too bad. Depression sounds much worse. Sure, but trichotillomania could be very debilitating, right? So there was a young woman who sent me an email a while back. She was suffering from this disorder, and she sent me pictures of her head. She had bald spots all over. She couldn't leave the house, meaning she couldn't go to work. She couldn't see friends. She couldn't go anywhere, right? It was ruining her life. So in that situation, what did she want to ask? She found that she could stop herself from hair pulling if she did some sort of needlework. I'll be very honest with you. I have no idea what the difference between crocheting and sewing and I don't know. So some sort of needlework that she wanted to do. And it was important for her to do that in order to stop herself from this. And of course, she wanted to know where she could do it on Shabbat, because it's something that's prohibited on Shabbat to do. And once again, we have a conflict between the halacha, Jewish law, and between a mental health consideration. There was another fellow out of a yeshiva, Har Etzion, who told me that he had the same problem. It was with his beard. Same problem. Found, for some reason, whatever, the coping mechanism for him was chewing gum. If he chewed gum, he didn't have to do it. He wanted to know whether he could chew gum on a fast day. Okay. So these are questions, right? So it's amazing how many questions there are, right? Things that you wouldn't even assume are questions. You know, people have questions all the time. Because if you know Jewish law, it seeps into every little piece of your life. That's how it is. And so every piece of your life is affected by Jewish law and is affected by whatever mental health issue you might be dealing with. And these are significant to people's ability to move forwards, to function, to do what they need to do. And I don't want to tell you about OCD, right, in Jewish law, which has to do with washing hands, with davening, you know, with all kinds of things. People who think that every thought that they have going through their mind is a vow that they have to keep. You know, people who... It's never ending. It's never ending. And I must tell you, I always say, like, you never even know where the next question is going to come from. That's what I do. That's what I do these days, almost all day, every day. That's what I do. I answer these questions, and I run this organization, which is supposed to help people navigate these questions and be able to live a proper and normal life with these questions. So far, so good? Okay, I hope that I've proven to you that I have what to do. Okay, that I'm busy. All right. So these are a handful of examples, but there are many, many questions that come my way. You might think, at this point, why did I come to this talk? Because, you know, okay, all these technical details, it's all very nice, you know, but like, what does this have to do with me? And the answer is that this is not just technical. I know it sounds technical. And yes, I'm a rabbi, and I learned the sources, and Rabbi Weiner spoke very generously about my book and how, you know, scholarly it is. It's all very nice and well. But when I started talking about this, I got an amazing, amazing feedback from the community. Look, I've been a rabbi for a long time, all right? And I've helped with the people with a lot of things. I almost never, and I'm not saying this to anyone's detriment, but I've almost never been offered money for my services. In other words, people call the rabbi and they assume the rabbi will answer their question and help them out, and that's it. And then they put down the phone and they're gone. Yeah? When I started answering mental health questions, people were saying, how can I support you? What can I do? You know, et cetera, et cetera. It was like very, very impactful for people. They were like, oh, this is so important, such important work. And I started asking myself, like, why is it such important work in people's eyes? I mean, I am not a mental health professional. I will tell you right now, okay, just to be clear, I'm not a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, I'm not a social worker, I don't hold any degrees in mental health, and I don't solve people's problems. I hope that's very, very clear. I answer a halachic question. Just because I have answered your question doesn't mean you don't have OCD anymore or don't have depression anymore. I've solved your halachic problem. I have not solved your problem. You still need to go see a mental health professional for whatever issue it is that you're suffering from. So, okay, so I'm a rabbi with a niche, right? You know how like some rabbis, they talk about the same thing all the time? You know what I'm talking about? Like for example, they like talking about Shemitah all the time. And some people, they like talking about Shabbos all the time, and so it's Sneas all the time. Okay, so now I'm the mental health rabbi. You know, like, but so what? Why does it matter so much? The answer has everything to do with what I think the topic of this talk is, which is stigma. To put it simply, to halachicize is to destigmatize. And I will show you what I mean by that right now. Okay? But let me put it to you very, very clearly. If we want to fight stigma about mental health in the Orthodox community, it must go through the halacha. There is no way for it not to go through the halacha. And so long as the halacha, as Jewish law, lags behind, there can never be a full and ultimate response to stigma within the Orthodox community. And that is why people responded so significantly to my work. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Why do I think that is so? Have you ever been to a sermon that the rabbi has given? Rabbi on Shabbos, he gets up, he gives some sermon, and you've disagreed with it. Has that ever happened? I'm guessing it's happened. Look, I've been a rabbi for 13 years in my community. I've given many, many drushas, many sermons. Like, no one's ever disagreed with me, right? Like, you know, it's never happened. Yeah, people all the time, they come up after they're over there, oh, Rabbi, I disagree with what you said, you know, okay, fine. You know, like, that's how it is, right? You disagree with the rabbi, 100%. Have you ever been to a shir? I don't know how many people attend shir, but have you ever been to a shir? Someone mentions a medrash, and someone says, oh, it's just a medrash. You ever heard that term? It's just a medrash. People are very, very... They're very okay, like, okay, whatever, you know. You said a nice idea at the Shabbos table, okay, maybe I agree, maybe I don't. But if the rabbi says that something is halacha, people stand at attention, right? It's not the same. If you go to some class on something, everyone can disagree. But if the rabbi invokes the Mishnah Brura, the Shulchan Aruch, if the rabbi invokes the Talmud, the rabbi invokes something that sounds authoritative, now it's like, well, I can't disagree with that. Why not? Why can't you disagree? It's halacha. Halacha makes things real. Halacha is not flighty. Halacha is not circumspect. Halacha makes things very, very real. If I tell a person, because they have a fever, that they can take medicine on Shabbat, then what message does that give the person? It gives the person a very clear message. It says, I believe you that you're not feeling well, and the halacha recognizes your situation, and it's real. It's totally, totally real. When a woman gives birth on Shabbos, we can order an ambulance or we could drive her to the hospital. Do people feel bad afterwards that they violated Shabbat for driving to the hospital? No, they do not. Why? Because the halacha is very, very clear. It says you must do this. And people feel that sense of comfort that the halacha has said that it's fine. So they don't feel bad. They don't feel guilty that they violated the Shabbos. But when I spoke before about someone using their phone on Shabbat in order to alleviate considerations of depression, anxiety, borderline personality disorder, some people here may have been kind of like moving uncomfortably, shifting uncomfortably in their chairs. Thinking, oh, is that really necessary? Like, how kosher is that? You know, like, is that really... In other words, what are you saying? What are you transmitting? And I'm not saying you're bad people, but what are you transmitting to the person who's suffering when you say that? You're saying, is it really that bad? Are you really suffering so much? Come on. Right, you can't go 25 hours without using your phone. Okay, you obviously don't know what depression is, if that's what you think. In other words, you're not taking this seriously enough, or you don't know what it is. You don't understand it. You don't get it, which is fine. People have to learn. They have to find out what these things really are. But you understand, when I halachasize, I destigmatize. When I decide that this thing is real enough for me to issue a ruling that says that you can violate Shabbat in one way or another, or that you don't have to fast on Yom Kippur because you have anorexia or bulimia or something else, or that you can, you know, go to an eating disorder program even though they serve treif because I believe that it's that bad that, yes, you have to go to the program, then I'm sending a very clear message to the individual and to the community. And I'm saying, this is real. We have to take it seriously. It's not a joke. It's not a game. And that's important. That message is very, very important. We cannot do it without halacha. Because why? Because if we don't do it with halacha, then we're sending the opposite message. That's the reason. If the rabbi stands from, you know, on the pulpit, right, and he delivers, you know, fire and brimstone, and he says, you know, how important it is, you know, to care for mental health conditions. He talks about it and goes on and on and on. But then when it comes to a practical ruling, he hems and haws and he says, I'm not so sure and I don't know, it may be and maybe not. Then it's all very nice. Then the rhetoric is all very nice. But you're really not willing to put your money where your mouth is. You're really not willing to say, this person is really suffering and really needs help. Unless you feel it, right? If there's a fever. Then it's okay. Then we accept it. But otherwise, we don't accept it. That's not good. All of this needs to be very, very real. And that's why we offer rabbinic training in our Maglan Nefesh, in our organization. The first thing that I instituted in the organization was rabbinic training. rabbis need to know what's going on. They need to understand the reality of the situation. If they don't, then they issue incorrect rulings. You know, I hear rabbis who sometimes, you know, issue rulings. I'm not going to go into all the details, but I'll give you one example. With OCD, for example. If you understand what OCD is, then you will understand how to rule about OCD. If someone asks me a question with OCD, the last thing that I would say to such an individual would be, well, you know, there are two opinions about this. No. There are no two opinions with OCD. There are no two opinions. Well, there are two options. There are no two options. You know, it's a machloket. It's not a machloket. There's nothing. There's only a yes or a no. There's a black or a white. That's what there is. Anyone who understands OCD will understand that anything other than that, other than you just telling the person what is okay and what is not okay. In other words, just to tell them most clearly and solidly tell them. Otherwise, you're just helping the OCD out. You're just digging a bigger hole for that individual. So rabbis who don't understand that will sometimes falter and start doing this. Yeah? And that's not good. That is not helpful. And rabbis are good people. 99% of my colleagues are good people. We sometimes hear only about the 1% because their names are splashed all over the papers when they do horrible things. But 99% of my colleagues are good, sensitive, helpful people. They just sometimes they're woefully ignorant about this issue of mental health. And so if they just knew, if they just understood, if they were just more familiar, then they could give the proper and correct ruling. And that's what we do, first of all. First and foremost, we train. And the gist of the training, right, is not the only thing we say a lot, but the gist of the training is, this is real. That's what this is. This is real. We've done 7 such trainings in Israel. We've done 2 in Australia. We've done 1 in the UK. I want to see if I could bring it to the US as well. But yes, to know that it's real. I always say, people say, oh, what's your goal? What do you want to achieve? If I could achieve that rabbis would treat mental health the way they treat physical health, then I will have achieved a lot. What does that look like? So I say, here's an example. Let's say a person comes to a rabbi and he says, Rabbi, I have a surgery scheduled for Shabbat. Can I go through with the surgery? I don't know what the rabbi will say, but I do know the kind of thing that the rabbi will say. Here's the kind of thing that he will say. This is more or less the template. The rabbi will say, you know, your surgery is important and Shabbat is important. Let's see what we can do to make sure you get both. Let's see what we can do to make sure that we make the most of our options over here. Sometimes the surgery will be important enough that we'll say, we have to desecrate the Shabbat. You have to do it on Shabbat. You have to get it done as soon as possible. And sometimes it'll be the kind of thing that you can postpone. And okay, fine, but we'll work it out. The message that the person will get is, we will work it out. I'm with you on this. I want to make sure you get the care that you need, both from a spiritual perspective and from a physical perspective. And that's all I want with mental health, is that when a person comes, they don't feel from the rabbi that he's dismissing the person's mental health as, oh, come on, is that really necessary? That kind of an attitude. But rather that, oh, yeah, that is important. Okay, let's see what we can do. Let's see how we can work this out. That's what we need to do. That's the kind of thing, that's the kind of result that I would like to see. And here I'd like to make an important point, which not everyone always understands, but that's why I emphasize it. This is not about leniency. Some people think that I'm talking about halachic leniency. And I'm not talking about it, but it's not only about that. To be clear, and this also is about stigma, when you give a leniency, you also stigmatize. You run the risk of stigmatization when you give a leniency. And I'll give you an example. It was a young woman in Migdal Oz, which is a seminary in Gush Etzion. She went to the seminary. She had anorexia, and she wasn't supposed to be fasting on Yom Kippur, so she didn't. The doctors told her she must eat on Yom Kippur, and she did. But imagine the scenario. You have 200 girls in an atmosphere on Yom Kippur, suffused with holiness, song, davening, camaraderie, everybody in the base midrash, everybody standing together, davening and praying and in a holy atmosphere, and she's in the dormitory eating. How does that feel? Does that not feel like you're a second-class citizen? Does that not feel like you've been pushed out of the community? Like you're not part? Is that not, to some extent, stigmatizing for the individual? That they feel like they're less than, that they feel like they're not part of. See, that's why it's not so simple to simply say, oh yeah, yeah, just take care of your health. I always explain it. I say, it's not enough. For an Orthodox person, that is not enough. They want to be religious. They want to be part of the community. Pushing them out of the community is not the solution. Telling them, just do whatever you need for your health, whatever it takes, you know, et cetera, et cetera, may sound like the sensitive thing to do. But it's not enough. We have to work harder than that. We have to work harder. We can't just tell the person to care for their health. We need to help them find a balance that's good for their soul and good for their health. To find a balance. When I tell people to listen to music on Shabbat, I tell them that if they can, they should try to make a playlist from before Shabbat and have it run throughout Shabbat, and have earphones hooked up, so then all they need to do is put in the earphones and don't have to press anything. Because there's a big difference for a person if they're like this all of Shabbos, and they feel like they're desecrating Shabbat and they're betraying God, or if they're not touching their phone, and all they need to do is when they need to, they put in the earphones and they listen, and when they don't need to, they take them out. It's not just a technical point like, oh, because you don't want them using the phone, I get it. No, you don't get it then. It's not just about the technical, halachic, legal question about whether they're pressing or they're not pressing. That's not about it. Not about that. If someone didn't care about Jewish law and didn't care about communal affiliation, they wouldn't ask me the question. They ask me the question because they want to remain part. That's what's important to them. And I need to find a way for that to happen, for them to remain part of the Jewish community while still caring for their mental health in the maximum way. It's not easy. It's hard. It's not simple to find that middle path, to find that balance for the person so that they feel normal, that they feel good. That's what we're aiming for. It's not about leniency. You think people don't want to fast on Yom Kippur? I fight people tooth and nail for them not to fast on Yom Kippur. You tell someone, anyone, almost at all, to not fast on Yom Kippur, they say, oh, come on. Right? Have you ever tried with like an elderly family member maybe? You know, well, I'll start and I'll see how I go. You know, like I'll do the evening and then, you know what I'm talking about? You know, it's like that sort of thing. Like people want to fast. They want to be part. They don't want to not fast. We're not going to fast. 70 years I've been fasting Yom Kippur. Now I'm not going to fast. You know, like are you crazy? Of course I'm going to fast Yom Kippur. Nobody wants to not fast. Nobody wants to not keep Shabbos. This is not like a yes, I got out of it kind of a situation. It's really not that. It's really not. So that's why also people say, aren't you afraid of a slippery slope? I'm really not. These people are not looking to get out of it. You got the wrong people. These are people who are interested in halacha, who are interested in community, who are interested in feeling good and feeling normal and feeling part. That's what they want. And we need to make sure that that can happen. And that leads me to maybe the most important part of today's talk, which is that if you understood everything that I've said until now, then you've also understood that in order for them to feel part, you, all of you, have a part as well. Maybe the biggest misconception about mental health that I have seen is the idea that for mental health problems, all we need is the mental health professionals. And that's not true. Mental health professionals fulfill a very important and central role. But if you think that's enough, then you're very, very wrong. Look, I've gotten the feedback from mental health professionals who have told me, they said to me, we're so happy that you're doing what you're doing. Why? We feel like we're in the trenches and now there's someone else with us. They need all the help they can get. It's not like, stay out of this, you know, et cetera. I mean, look, I know I stay in my lane. I don't give therapy because I'm not a therapist and I don't have the skills. I do my own thing. My point is that I have a thing to do. If anything, on the last, how long have I been talking? I don't even know. Yeah. But whatever half an hour or 35 minutes have hopefully proven to you is that I have a role to play, even though I'm not a mental health professional. And if that's true about me, then it's true about you as well. And I'll explain what I mean by the fact that we all have something to do. I always give the example of someone who was in a car accident and is in a wheelchair now. Okay, and he comes to the synagogue, and he wants to go, and suddenly he sees there's no ramp, there's only stairs. Who's going to build the ramp? The occupational therapist who took care of him? The physical therapist? The doctors in the hospital? They all have a role to play, sure, but none of them are going to build the ramp for that person to get into shul in his wheelchair. Who's going to build the ramp? The community. The community has a role, has a job to do with regards to people who are living in that community. And we can't shy away from that job. We have things to do. I once gave a talk in Beit Shemesh to, I don't know if you have an equivalent of this. In Beit Shemesh we have a 55 plus group. Is there an equivalent of that here somewhere? I gave a talk to the 55 plus group, and there was an elderly retired rabbi in the crowd, and he said to me, "Oh, you reminded me of something we did when I was a rabbi." I said, "Okay, what was it?" He said, "When I was a rabbi, in the foyer of the shul on Yom Kippur, we put a table with little cups of orange juice, and we put a sign over it, and it said, 'V'nishmartem me'od nafshotechem,' right, to care for your health. If your doctor says that you must drink, you know, because of pregnancy or sickness or whatever it is." I said to him, "It's a nice story. If I put a table in my shul and I wrote, 'If you are suffering from an eating disorder, you know, feel free to take a cup of orange,' no one would come anywhere close to that table." That's where we are communally, right? That's where we are. We're not in the place where people feel like they're supported by the community and the community is building the ramps to make them feel comfortable and good in the community. No, we're in the place where people would rather not come to shul rather than face the judgment of the community or how they look at them. I had a fellow in my community, I'm sure you've seen similar things. He had a heart, a cardiac event. We have a defibrillator. They took out the defibrillator. They did whatever they did. They took him to the hospital. God willing, Baruch Hashem, thank God, he was fine. 2 or 3 weeks later, he came back to shul. He came back to shul. It was like, there was no shame in it. There's no shame in it. Okay, something happened. I came back to shul. I know people who tell me that if they come to shul because of their depression, they will start crying. And if they start crying, then there'll be like this radius around them where no one will know what to do. No one will know whether to go towards them or not. They feel awkward. Why should I come to shul just to feel awkward? So forget it. So they don't come to shul. For months, they don't come to shul. Just because they know they'll start crying in the middle of davening. And why should they put themselves through that? No one knows what to do with them anyway. Many of us will, even if we know that someone is suffering from depression, will feel awkward at a Shabbos table to have that conversation or to broach it. Or if they see them on the street, right? If you know that someone went through cancer treatments, many times you will go over to that person and you will say, "Oh, how are you? I heard what you're going through," or whatever. "How are you doing? Is it, you know, et cetera? How are you feeling? It's good to see you." But with depression or anxiety or other things, we don't even know how to broach the conversation. So what do? We don't want to put our foot in our mouth. We don't want to be awkward about it. So we don't say anything. So then what does the person feel? Like they're invisible. That's not a good way to handle things. The way to make people feel like they're welcome in the community is not by ignoring them because you're afraid you will say the wrong thing. And I understand why people are afraid they'll say the wrong thing. But you can learn. We should learn. We should have communal efforts to learn how to talk to people with mental health conditions. That's not a bad thing to do. You take a psychologist or a psychiatrist, social worker, and you have an evening just like this, you know, and they come and they say, "Okay, here's the do's and don'ts. Here's what you say, what you don't say, you know, et cetera." These are things that we can do. These are things that we can learn. But the point is that our communities need to build the ramps. the need to build the ramps for people with mental health conditions to feel good. And that's for us to do. No one else is going to do that. That's my point. No one else is going to do that. And here's my other point. If I ask people here whether they want to help with mental health, people with mental health challenges, I know that all of you would raise your hands. And you would say, absolutely. I'm in, Rabbi. Of course I want to help. And I know why you would say you're in, because you're good people. Everybody here in the crowd is a good person. However, I want to be very, very clear. Helping people with mental health challenges does not come without sacrifice. It does not come without sacrifice. If you think it's going to be easy, then I think you're wrong. And let me tell you a little story which you all know. You know, so just to kind of drive the point home. So maybe you remember this famous story about the Baal Shem Tov, the great Hasidic master, who one Yom Kippur, you know, they're davening and a child comes in, he doesn't know how to pray, starts whistling, or according to one version, he has a flute or whatever it is. The point is, he doesn't know how to read the lines out of the Siddur, so he starts whistling, you know, because that's what he, and everyone shushes him. And then the Baal Shem Tov says, that's his way of praying, right? That's the way that he communicates with God. Let him do it. It's a beautiful story. One thing that should bother all of you about that story is that we are the shushers in that story, not the Baal Shem Tov, right? In your shul, if someone came in during the Neilah and started whistling, what would you do? You'd shush him. Let's be honest. You wouldn't be like, hey, that's the way he prays, right? You would be like, that's not cool. Let's get that kid out of here, you know, right? We all like the story. Let me put it to you differently, okay? Let's say I'm not a doubter. Let's say the story really happened, okay? Someone came home that year, that Yom Kippur, to his wife and said, that was a really annoying davening. I stood right next to this kid who was whistling the entire time. It was pretty annoying, right? The Baal Shem Tov said to do it, so we did it, you know? But I'm never going back to that shul again, that's for sure, you know, that sort of thing, yeah? It was annoying. See, this is the thing. It's not going to come without sacrifice. You want to be sensitive, and you are sensitive people. You want to be good to people, and that's true. But are you willing to sit next to someone with dementia in shul who's shouting out every now and then? Are you willing to sit next to the kid with ADHD who needs a fidget cube or a spinner or needs to walk around a little bit, you know, because he can't sit still and it annoys you because you want to have kavana, because you want to have intent in davening, and you want to have how much chaos are you willing to put up with? I'm not saying we should let people, like, you know, put out like a Monopoly game on the Bima. You know, I'm not going that far. Okay, I'm not saying that shul should turn into chaos. I'm not advocating that. But are you willing to stretch the borders of the community a little bit? How much room are you willing to give? Are you willing to stand next to a whistling kid during Ne'ilah? Or do you need your peace and quiet? So I know we all are sensitive people. But it's a real challenge here. It's a real challenge. And I told the rabbi the other day, you know, I said, you know, if you're looking, I was saying, in my job, like, you know, with mental health, if you're looking for a thank you, you're not going to get it. A lot of the people who are dealing with mental health issues, they're just dealing with a lot. They don't have the space in their mind right now to acknowledge what you've done for them, and to thank you, and to give you accolades, and to speak about you, and all this stuff. That's not, no, mostly it's going to be like, you know, I need something, and that's it. And sometimes, even worse, sometimes they'll get angry at you for trying to help them, and they won't talk to you for 2 weeks, which has happened to be, you know, more than once, especially with borderline personality disorder, which is understandable because it's mood swings, and it's up and down, and, you know, et cetera. And sometimes people get mad at you, and they don't want to talk to you anymore, and they're offended by you, and all you did try to do was help. But fine. If you're in it for you, for like a pat on the back, well, it's really not going to happen a lot of the times. A lot of times it's just going to be you helping because it's L'shem Shamayim, because you have to help, because that's what it is. But we need to come together as a community and understand that sacrifice is worth it. And why is it worth it? And this is the last point that I'll make, and then I'll finish my monologue, and I'm happy to open up for questions or comments. The reason that it's so important is normalization. Look, when someone goes to a mental health professional or when someone's hospitalized, they don't feel normal. They feel abnormal. They feel like something's wrong with them. I've gone to three therapists, to three psychologists in my life. Now all of you are thinking, what happened? Why did he go? What happened to him? Yeah, right? Because now you think, like, maybe I'm not normal. Yeah, okay, 100%. That's what happens, right? When you admit something like that, then people are saying, oh, something's wrong with you. Okay. But here's the thing. When someone comes to me, my job is to make them feel normal. That's what I can do. When you go to a therapist, sometimes you feel abnormal. Although when I spoke at, I was in San Diego earlier this week, and I said this in class to one of the girls in the high school, and she said, it's California, everybody goes to therapists, it's not abnormal. But besides that that interesting point, which I'm not sure is entirely true, but besides that interesting point, I would say that that it does feel a little bit abnormal, you know, when you're at a therapist, meaning you feel like something's wrong with you. And when I halachasize, when I paskin, when I rule, when I'm bringing them into the community, that's what I'm trying to do, I'm making them feel normal again. That's what I can do. I can make them feel like they're part, like they're not a second-class citizen. Like, just like anybody else asks me a question, they too can come and ask me a question. Just like everybody else can get an answer and the halacha takes them into account and they're within the big tent of Judaism, this person is also within the big tent and we're going to take care of this person. We're going to take care of them just like we take care of anybody else. And when the community, when you guys do all the things that I was talking about before, you do the same thing. This is our big chance to make people feel normal, not the opposite of normal. That's our job. Let the therapists do their job. They have to take care of all the things that are going on, and it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be simple. They're going to do their job. They're going to do it good. But when people leave the hospital or they leave therapy, which they do once a week, the rest of the week they're with us. The rest of the week they're with us. And then we have to create a life for them, a life that makes sense, a life that's good, a life that's decent, a life that has value, a life that's normal. And I want to say one word about the war in Israel right now, and with that I'll finish. There's a lot of tragedy that's in this war, which I'm sure you realize, and I'm sure you know. And two fellows already from my community died in the first days. There was one guy who... I'm sorry, it's a little bit hard for me to talk about it. There was one guy who... He grew up in my community. He was living in Jerusalem. In the morning of Simchas Torah, he... 8:30, he got the call to come down. He was in one of the elite units in the army. And he was one of the people called first. And 8:30 from Jerusalem, he got in the car and he drove like crazy. And by 10:30, he was in the fighting. He was in the midst of the fire at 10:30 already. You know, we can't imagine it. They were not trained for this. When they train units in the army, they don't train them to go 10 against 100. They train them, you know, to go against odds that make sense. These people, right, they show up, the units of 8, 10, 12 people, and the terrorists are everywhere, right? They're everywhere. And they're shooting at you from every angle. It's unimaginable. And there are civilians stuck inside. And you run into the fire time and again to save men, women, and children. It's you can't imagine it. What heroism, what bravery. It's unbelievable. You know, we all came out of the Chag, we all came out of the holiday thinking to ourselves, we're shocked. Like, how could Israel have been so unprepared? Right? How could there have been how could this have happened? Right? Like, such a failure on part of Israel's part. Yes, such a failure on part of Israel's generals. Such success on part of Israel's soldiers. The first responders to this tragedy we can't even imagine the heroism. They saved human lives like you wouldn't believe. They went in, they saved a person, and they went back in, and they saved another one, and they went back in, they saved until the bullets hit them. Until the bullets or the RPG or whatever it is hit them, and then they fell. But in those first moments, this is what they did. And we're gonna come out of this war scarred. Whatever the result is, whatever it is, it's gonna be a long road for mental health. Because I just talked to you about normalization. And war is not normal. The reality in war is not normal. People are going to need a lot of therapy. Yes. They're going to need a lot of normal. They're going to need a lot of normalization. They're going to need a lot of support. That support is going to come from us, not only from mental health professionals. If you think that mental health professionals are the answer to this, they are only the first responder, the first line of defense for someone who's gone through a trauma. But they're not the end of that. To create a life, to create a good life, a proper life, a life that is worth living, that is good, that a person can move on from such a tragedy, from these odds, from these incredible stories. For that, we need us. And I dare say, and I apologize for the pride, an organization like Magla Nefesh, yes, also is needed. To train rabbis, to respond to people when in their time of need, to normalize things within our communities, to help people find a life within whatever framework they're trying to find. And I think we all have to take part in that. So, thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much for any support that you can give us in our organization. And I am happy to take any questions or comments that people have. Please.
Are you saying that the people that call you are actually the mentally ill person? Not the husband or the wife or the mother or whatever. It's the actual person that's from and also has mental illness.
It varies. It's both. But yes, many times it is that person.
Isn't it hard? I mean, I have a son who refuses to go for therapy. It's already so many years. And it started with his mental illness when he's already 40 years old. What happened? What happened to all of Deal, New Jersey, with the Syrian community where he was living? Nobody paid attention. My son was going crazy.
It's horrible. You're right.
He refuses to at least acknowledge
right.
There is something wrong and that he should get right. Attention.
I'm sorry to hear that. It's hard. Very hard. Yes. Right.
How would you respond to that, or these books, or any of that?
Well, it doesn't really matter how I respond, right? Because facts are facts. It doesn't always help. In other words, I could claim that it's true, but it's not. There are plenty of individuals who have plenty of faith, who I know personally some individuals like that, where I've known them for probably 15, 20 years even. And I knew them when they were well and they had plenty of emunah, etc. And then they were afflicted by one mental health condition or another. And and it's impossible now, you know? So it's look, There are a lot of things that people say that aren't exactly true. For example, I would never say to someone with a mental health condition, the line that many people like to say, God does not give a person a something that he cannot handle. Yeah, so I feel like that's, you're kind of like spitting in that person's face a little bit, because they really feel like they can't handle it. You know, so you're telling them, oh, you can, you know, but I can't, Rabbi, but I really can't. I'm dying here. I can't handle it. You can. I mean, I think that that is a very cruel thing to say. So the same thing with the line that you said just now. I think that faith can help a person. I'm not denying that. I think that religion can be an anchor. I think it could give stability. I think there are plenty of positive things that religion can be used for to give a person strength and resilience in their life. Yes, I do believe that that's true, but only when done right. Religion, when done right, could be a blessing. When done wrong, could be horrible. And already the rabbis wrote that in the Talmud. They said, you know, it could be a sam hamavet, it could be a deathly poison, you know, and it could be a blessing. But it really depends how you do it. We need to do it right. That's the bottom line. Yeah.
Well, I just want to comment on some things that you mentioned. One is you know, the stigma issue. When you've got a person who has some form of mental health disorder, I think one of the biggest challenges is to get the person to seek help from a clinician.
Sure.
And very often there's a lack of insight. And unfortunately, when the insight wanes, it's just literally nothing one can do.
Yep.
But having worked with many psychiatrists and clinicians who've said to me, and I just want to reiterate, I'm not a clinician, I'm just somebody who cares deeply for people, and particularly in the Jewish community. I've heard numerous times where the clinician has said, I've administered the treatment, and the patient or the client tells me that people just don't accept them. People just don't care about them. And they won't invite them for Shabbos. And they're afraid of them. And, you know, hopefully through your training with the rabbis, this is something that you can work on. You know, obviously there's the halachic side, but there's also the chizuk side.
Absolutely.
That connects to the halachic.
Yes.
Is because when people come into the shul, or they come into the community, and, you know, they've got a disorder of schizo disorder, or maybe struggle with severe depression, you know, I think of one particular situation where a psychiatrist said to me, all this person wants is to be loved, acknowledged, and cared about.
Yep.
And nobody in the community would reach out to this person. And, you know, through experience, bringing this person for Shabbos and also encouraging other people to be aware, this person needs a little extra love without embarrassing them. So I think it's very, very important for our community to, you know, make a greater effort, particularly when people come out of treatment or they are working with a clinician. Unfortunately, when they're not, it's a challenge that is beyond our scope. And I couldn't agree with you more that acceptance and love and tolerance, and as you said, like I see people in shul, you know, they'll be walking up and down and spinning their hand and they can't sit still, and it could be a form of ADHD, is to look at them and say, that person's normal. There's nothing abnormal about it. It's just a condition.
Yep. I'll just say one quick line about what you just said, you know, which is I was saying this to Susan before as well, you know, that I've seen it many, many times because I deal with so many people. There are very sweet people living under the mental health condition, yeah? And a lot of times we don't see those people because all we see is the condition. That's part of the stigma, you know, is that we only see the condition. We only see the depression. We only see the anxiety. We only see the OCD, you know, and it covers a lot of times, you know, the person's personality, who they are, you know, but if you just try to look, you'll see all that. You'll see the beauty of the person, You'll see the lovely individual that's I talk to a lot of people who are shunned by society, and I feel like I know the real them. You know, like I feel on some level, I know who they really are. I feel bad that society is not able to see past that, you know, and to be able to really get something from them. Anyway, yeah.
This will be the last question.
Sorry. Yeah. I'll be very honest with you. I've been doing this for the organization has only been around for 2 years. It's very hard for me to supply data, you know, of change and you know, et cetera, as a result of my work, just because I haven't been doing it for so long. But with the community rabbis that I've worked with, meaning with the rabbis in Israel that I've done training with, I have seen small changes. Like I still haven't seen, you know, over time. But I have seen some changes starting to crop up within their communities, within their personalities, with the way that they answer questions, you know, etc. My feeling is, and this I'll just say this, and with this we'll end, right? People always say to me, oh, so I would be happy to help, but people with mental health conditions don't come to me because they don't want to, because of the stigma, they don't want to, you know, tell that they have, whatever it is. People just don't come up. We'd be happy to help, but they don't come up. So I say to people, look, I'm aware that that's a situation. I have news for you. You will have to come to them. So what does that mean? I always say, people don't come to me only because I'm the mental health rabbi. That's true. At the beginning, the reason was because I instigated. Meaning, I posted on Facebook. I wrote about what I was doing. You know, I came out and said, I'm the address for this. Come to me. I want to know your story. I want to know what's going on. If a community decides to put, let's say, for example, on their weekly email that goes out to everybody to say, if you have a mental health, you know, this is our point person, you know, etc. Even if no one comes to that point person for a year or two or even three, at least people know that the community cares enough to write that so that they want to know, so that there is someone that they've designated, you know, etc., etc. You might say, oh, but that's like just like the regular person who's in charge of the, I don't know. I think that with this, maybe it's good to write it explicitly. To say, this is actually our person. In other words, all I'm saying is, the rule is, okay, however you want to do it, the rule is, you need to instigate. In other words, people will not come to us. They won't. The people with mental health conditions will not take the chance that they will be shunned, that they will be pushed away, that people will not react to them properly. They need to be wooed. They need to be run after. We need to put ourselves out first. We need to take the steps to make them feel comfortable, and then they'll come out of the woodwork. That I can tell you from experience. I get more questions in a week now than I got in 13 years of being a rabbi before. Okay, so the moment that I put myself out there, the moment that it was clear that I was an address for this, there's a whole world out there we don't know about. Okay, and we can help those people, and they can trust us, but we need to first put ourselves out there. Thank you.
Rabbi Rosenfrei said.
Rabbi Rosenzweig said he was ending with this, but the truth is, this is just the beginning. This is a conversation we need to be having more often. We look forward to being in touch with you about it more often. Thank you so much for coming so we can have this conversation. I have parking validations here. We also have the CME credits. Thank you again to Susan. It should be a blessing for your brother's memory. Thank you all for coming. Awesome.